KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I sat down and they were like, you know what? We're sick of our ideas. Do you have any? And I like really, truly did not, which just for any writers out there, just always have an idea in your back pocket because just better to be prepared. And I really didn't have anything.
A couple of years ago, TV writer Liz Feldman, a veteran of the Ellen DeGeneres Show and Two Broke Girls, took a casual meeting with some producers. She'd been told she didn't need to come with any specific ideas. Turns out she kind of did. The previous week, Feldman had lost a family member unexpectedly and found out that her fertility treatment had failed again. So Feldman was immersed in loss and asked to deliver an idea on the spot. That informed her response. Thus, the seeds were planted for the Netflix dramedy Dead to Me, a wickedly funny show about grief. Feldman tells us about a twisty career path that led to her twisty, turny new show. But first on the news banter, Fox guards its henhouse. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So there was a case that I think we talked about in our year ahead banter, this litigation that was brought by Fox, which now, of course, is part of Disney. So it's Fox and Disney against Netflix. And Netflix, as we have discussed, has been trying to bulk up as other studios are starting their streaming services. And, you know, they're going to take back important pieces of Netflix programming that Netflix doesn't own. Netflix is ramping up originals like crazy, spending a damn fortune. We are all witnessing this. Huge deals. And as they're doing that, they're poaching a lot of executives, and they poached some from Fox. And Fox kind of went to court and said, hey, you know, you cannot interfere with our relationships with our employees. And the court has only issued a tentative ruling saying that it's going to side with Fox in this dispute. Assuming that that sticks, that means that a gigantic disruption that could have happened in the way deals are done here with people who work for studios, that won't happen.
Yeah, this was a big threat to the status quo. And in the industry, it's, you know, the same with talent as it is with executives. A lot of them are signed to deals. And if you're a creative executive at Fox, you have a 3-year deal or a 4-year deal. And the expectation is that the company will honor that and that you will honor that. California law is very friendly to people who would like to move around. So if you actually want to leave your company and get a job elsewhere, the law is pretty much on your side with exceptions. But what was interesting here is that Fox went after Netflix, not the people who left for greener pastures. They said Netflix, by throwing around money and by actively recruiting people and targeting people at the studio, it was interfering with long-standing contracts, and that's against the law. And the case really was a referendum on this ability to move around and could have potentially upended the entire contract system, not just within Hollywood, but elsewhere in California. And the judge essentially said, no, we're going to honor the sanctity of a contract. You can't just come in and say, we're going to throw 2, 3, 4 times as much money at you and just go one by one picking off people. You will be held accountable if you start to do that.
Now, Fox didn't really look to get a lot of money out of this. They asked for $1. They were trying to establish a principle, but, you know, they're trying to make a point. The point seems to be made. I assume Netflix will, if the final verdict matches this one, appeal, and we'll see. But so far, it's status quo reigning as opposed to huge upheaval on that score.
As you mentioned, Netflix has been poaching like crazy. I mean, it seems like every couple days I get an email from someone I've worked with saying, hi, you know, I was formerly at Disney. I am now at Netflix. And it's just one after another. And they're doing this because the clock is running and they know they need to staff up and bulk up because the studios are coming after them. So this is a pretty big decision business-wise.
Meanwhile, the other Netflix story that I sort of follow, I'm somewhat amused by, among the people that they hired from Fox, this is not the executives involved in the lawsuit, but they just hired someone who was a high-level distribution executive at Fox. The Disney merger probably put an end to that. They don't need all those people. They've got duplications with the people they have at the studio. But for Netflix to hire a film distribution guy, this is the company. It was like, oh no, we will never make a big thing of theatrical because this is not our model. And we saw Alfonso Cuarón kind of break the back of that, or at least start to really fracture the back of that with his Roma strategy. He wanted it in theaters. There is a clear message that's been underlying from the beginning. You want auteur directors. They are going to want theatrical. That's the way they feel. So I feel like what we're seeing generally, it's part of a incremental move that Netflix is making to become in some ways more like a studio. They came in, they're digital, they're disruptors, we reinvent the wheel. But then it turns out there are certain things about the existing wheel that weren't so bad.
This is about awards, and this is about appealing to talent. Netflix very much wants to be in the Oscar race, and they know to do that, they have to give these Oscar-caliber filmmakers somewhat of a traditional release. That's why they bought the Egyptian Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, so that they can have a big splashy premiere and invite the whole town to their theater, and it will play within the industry just like a traditional movie, even though 99% of the people who consume the product will consume it on their TVs.
Yeah, and probably most filmmakers will not be getting that kind of treatment, but still, they're just inching towards that old thing. Now, as we are speaking, X-Men Dark Phoenix is coming into theaters, and I just will note this is kind of the culmination of the old Fox version of that universe. You know, back when Marvel was not the powerhouse that it is now, they licensed these characters. They licensed Spider-Man to Sony, and Fox got the X-Men and the Fantastic Four, you know, Deadpool, all of that is from those days. Now, Disney bought Fox. They've got it. It'll be interesting. We can't say at this taping how this movie will do, but what we do know is that this is the end of an era of that iteration of the X-Men universe. And someone who knows a few things about Marvel, Kevin Feige. Kevin Feige has new toys, and I'm sure he's already well on the way to figuring out what he's going to do with those toys.
Oh, of course. But one thing to note is Fox has done pretty well with X-Men, starting with the original X-Men movie that Bryan Singer did in 2000, 2001.
Right. I mean, his name cannot be mentioned. Now, yeah. But go on.
But, you know, they have managed that property pretty well and managed to milk it for many, many years. You know, you mentioned the Deadpool spinoff. They did a Wolverine series of films. The fact that this is now under the Disney banner, it will be interesting to see how it gets incorporated, because the X-Men movies, some of them have been rated R. Deadpool is not something that you would think Disney would ever touch, because it is not the quote-unquote Marvel or Disney brand as Disney knows it. So will they be willing to do that stuff? I think they got to. If you want to keep releasing superhero films, you have to diversify them and have all different kinds of superhero films. So will there be room for R-rated ones? Who knows? I think yes.
I mean, I think yes, it's going to be interesting to see Kevin Feige navigate maybe a darker, edgier R-rated world. I don't think we've seen that. So I'll end by noting how delicate these things are. We just saw Robert Pattinson is going to be the new Batman for Warner Brothers. This is Matt Reeves's version, you know, all kinds of fan reaction. Inevitably, I will just say, I will boldly go on the record and say, I think Robert Pattinson is a great choice. I am interested to see this. I think Matt Reeves is a good choice as a director, and we'll see how Warner's does. They've had their problems with this kind of movie, but every time you're taking your life in your hand with those fans. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In the Netflix dramedy series Dead to Me, Christina Applegate plays new widow Jen, in shock after a hit-and-run killed her husband while he was out for a late-night jog. Grieving and angry, she reluctantly goes to a grief support group where she meets...
Hi. I'm Judy.
Hi.
Hi. Jen. Are you coming to this group often?
No, this is my first time here.
Me too.
Oh.
Judy is played by Linda Cardellini. She tells Jen and the others in the group that she's just lost her fiancé. And at first, they believe her. Jen and Judy don't seem to have much in common. Jen is a tightly wound high-end real estate agent who spends her free time looking for cars with human-sized dents. Judy is a gentler spirit who teaches art classes at a retirement home. Yet the two women bond over the shared experience of sudden loss. Dead to Me was created by Liz Feldman, a TV comedy writer with a varied resume. She's come up with blue-collar jokes for Jeff Foxworthy, nice clean monologues for Ellen, and raunchy scripts for Two Broke Girls. Before she did any of that, she started with stand-up at the ripe old age of 16.
Yeah, I don't know. I had sort of a calling to do it from a pretty early age. And it wasn't necessarily my idea to become a stand-up. I had a mentor who saw an ad in Backstage Magazine.
You had a mentor at 16?
Yeah, I was like a kid actor kind of thing.
Were?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and not a super successful one, but I just wanted to be in this business from seemingly birth. And nobody in my family's in the business. It doesn't really make any sense. I'm from Brooklyn, and I started auditioning and taking myself on the subway about 13 years old, you know, to ads that I found in Backstage Magazine for like kids who wanted to be stars. And I ended up getting into a show, like an off Broadway show for kids. And we got to write our own show. And the director of that was a woman named Hillary Scarl, who I'm still friends with to this day. And she sort of saw something in me that I didn't even see really in myself. And she found this ad in Backstage Magazine for kids who write and perform their own jokes. And she said, I think you could do that.
So from there, you go to improv.
Yeah, I loved improv from the first moment I did it. And that was actually with Hillary Scarl. She was my first improv teacher. And I think improv is sort of the seeds of writing. I mean, it is. It's like you're coming up with the idea on the spot. You're creating a character. You're telling a story. It's imperfect. But, you know, writing is really just the next stage of that.
Right. And it forces you to move forward.
Exactly.
You cannot stand there and say, I'm blocked.
Exactly. And I still improvise to this day with the Groundlings, and it's my greatest joy. It's the thing that brings me the most, like, just pure fun in my life. And, you know, I'm really grateful that that's how I started, because it's a great foundation for becoming a writer.
So you have this blue collar TV. Is that the next thing?
Actually, my first job was in 1995 on a show called All That. It was on Nickelodeon, and I was 18 years old, and I got the job about 3 weeks after I graduated from high school. I was supposed to go to Vassar College.
I was going to say, there go your parents' seven sisters' dreams.
Exactly. I moved to Orlando, Florida by myself.
Oh my God.
3 weeks after I graduated from high school, and took this job. I was the only female writer in the room. And that was my first experience in television. It was crazy.
That's crazy. Right?
It was a big leap for me. And I was fired.
You were fired?
I was fired.
Oh my God.
I think it's important to talk about that, because I had no idea what I was doing. I was 18 years old. And the only thing I'd ever written was like an essay to try to get into college. I had no idea how to write sketch comedy. And there was another element to the show that was really difficult, in that I was very sexually harassed in the writer's room.
Oh, goodness. And that, while you were 18.
Yeah, I was 18 and I was the only woman.
It could happen at any age, as we know, but 18 especially,
yeah,
vulnerable.
And I didn't even realize at the time that that's what was happening. But I was being put in a pretty uncomfortable position by my boss at that time. And, you know, it's not something I've really ever talked about. But, you know, I realized looking back, I'm a 42-year-old woman now. I'm an executive producer. I'm a showrunner. And to think of myself at 18 in that room being treated like that, it actually like sort of breaks my heart for myself at that age.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what do you do? You're 18. You're fired. You're in Orlando.
Well, I moved back home to Brooklyn and all my friends were in college. And I started visiting my best friend from high school, who is the actor Dan Fogler. And he went to Boston University. And while I was visiting him, he was auditioning for the improv group on campus. And he said, you should come. And I was like, well, I don't go to school here. He said, so what? So I did. I went and we auditioned together and we both got in. And they sort of said to me, well, if you came to school here, you could be in this group. And so literally the next day I walked into the admissions office and I applied to go to school at BU. I sat there for an interview and I started in January. And I literally went to Boston University to be in the improv group called Spontaneous Combustion.
I can't believe that's a thing. Like, hello, I'm here. I'm good at improv. Please let me into your college.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think my parents realized that's why I was trying to go to school there. But, you know, it all worked out.
So, okay, you are then going to graduate. I assume you graduated. I'm not going to make any more assumptions, though.
I did. I graduated on time with my class, which was like a big goal of mine so that I didn't have to be behind. And I went immediately to Los Angeles. And the first thing I did was enroll at the Groundlings, and I was in the Groundlings for 5.5 years. you know, I was acting. I was doing little bit parts on TV shows as like a weird little character actress. And I thought I was doing pretty well until I sort of looked at my finances and I thought, wow, okay, I've done maybe 5 or 6 appearances on television. I have literally nothing to show for it. And I was working in a restaurant, no shame in that game. And I decided, you know, I'm a writer and I know it. And I've been scared to go back to it because of that experience that I had had. And I decided when I was about 26 years old that I was going to try my hand at that again and that I was going to sort of take back the experience of being a television writer. And my first job back was on a show called Blue Collar TV, which seems like an odd fit, but it kind of worked.
Yes, I was waiting for to get to Blue Collar TV because it seems like an odd fit. Jeff Foxworthy and Larry the Cable Guy. And I mean, you had nothing in your background that was country.
No, I'm a Jew from Brooklyn, and it did not seem like it would make any sense for me to be writing.
How did you sell yourself?
I sold myself because I had done this two-woman show with a good friend of mine, the writer Pamela Ribbon. And in that show, I played a Southern man. This is very strange. It was a show with multiple characters. It was called Letters Never Sent. And basically, we played characters who wrote these letters that they never sent. And yeah. One of my letters was from a Southern man to the show The L Word. And he was like this like real Southern, you know, I can't even do it now. My accent is long gone. I lost that guy a long time ago. But he couldn't understand why he loved The L Word so much. And that it was like doing things to him that he just couldn't, even though he didn't agree with homosexuality.
Right, God is against it, but I'm for it.
Yeah, but somehow I can't stop watching. So I submitted that along with certain sketches I had written at the Groundlings. And I think they saw some form of a connection there. And again, they needed to hire a female writer, and I was the only female writer in the room.
Hopefully a better experience.
It was a better experience, yeah. I mean, it was still, you know, a boys' club, and there were definitely things said where I just sort of had to go, okay. But, you know, for the most part, they were really supportive, and I really found my footing on that job. And I realized from actually having success on that show that I could do this and that I could make a living and that if I wanted to, I could probably succeed as a writer.
And then Ellen.
Yeah. So coming off of a show like Blue Collar TV, which was, you know, in many ways a huge moment in my career and that it got me back in the door, it wasn't exactly aligned with my paradigm in life. You know, I just figured if I'm going to be a writer, I want to write for somebody that I absolutely love and adore and respect and somebody who really more lines up with my ethos, if you will. And I had always loved Ellen. She was totally my idol growing up. You know, I was a stand-up at 16. I'm gay. And I didn't even know when
she
I started.
She wasn't really out at that
point. No, she wasn't. I just felt something simpatico with her. I always did. And I mean, she's also brilliant. So that helps. So when her talk show started, I wasn't writing yet. I was actually, it was pre-Blue Collar TV, but I started writing monologues for her just to see if I could because I loved her so much. And I thought, oh, let me see if I can write.
I'm fascinated by the idea of writing a monologue for a stand-up. Like,
yeah, I just, you know, I knew every joke she ever told. I was such a huge fan. And all of a sudden, here she is on TV doing a monologue every day. And I thought, like, as an exercise, I'm just going to see if I can write in her voice. So I started writing these monologues. I kind of stored them away, got that job on Blue Collar. And then, you know, I heard from my new agent that they were looking for writers on Ellen. And I took out those monologues that I had written sort of in the dark and, you know, freshened them up and submitted them and got the job.
I mean, the idea of writing for this daytime show, and I really wonder, how does a show like that work? What's your role?
So my role was to write her opening monologue of every show, which was usually a topic that she chose that morning or maybe sometimes the previous day. But again, having an improv background really helped me in that job because I could very quickly think of, okay, what are the 10 funny things about this one subject? And she had a real strong hand in her monologue, of course, because, you know, some of the jokes were hers, some of them would be ours. But we would work on it together, which for me was really the thrill of the job because I learned how to be a better joke writer by working with her because she's a perfectionist and she knows what's funny. And so she would push me pretty much every day that I wrote for her to be better and be like, I think we can beat this joke. And she was always right. And I think I got a lot of my work ethic from her.
Coming up after a short break, Liz Feldman tells us how Dead to Me star Christina Applegate bravely offered up her own life-altering situation as material for her character. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Liz Feldman, creator of the Netflix series Dead to Me. The show follows the unlikely friendship of Jen and Judy, played by Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. The two meet at a grief support group, and though Jen isn't the warm, cuddly type, she finds herself drawn to her new friend. Toward the end of the first episode, Jen sits beside Judy on the beach as the two share a joint in the dark.
Can I say something weird?
Please.
Thank you.
For what?
I don't know, just for coming into my life, I guess, like... a weird little pot fairy. And also just we're not saying and doing the same stupid that everybody says and does that just makes you feel more alone than you already are, you know? And for not being repulsed by my version of grief.
Dead to Me, which came out of grief in Feldman's life, is far different from any other series on her resume, which includes 4 seasons of the CBS sitcom Two Broke Girls.
So coming off of Two Broke Girls, I actually created a show called One Big Happy that was on NBC, and it was very short-lived, you know, which gave me the opportunity to be a showrunner and to have my own show and have that experience, which was great. And coming off of that show, you know, I started writing pilots again, and CBS Studios had read a pilot that I had written for their network that they had passed on, but they saw something in that script and they were like, we would like to work with you. And so, you know, in terms of writing for television, having an overall deal is a really ideal situation because it's a, you know, it's a steady paycheck and you're with a studio that supports you and gets you. And
theoretically,
you know, for me, I have to say I've been incredibly lucky with CBS Studios because they hired me to be a multi-camera writer, you know, for network television. And then I brought them this very weird, dark, twisty, turny dramedy that would never be on a network. And to their credit, they really embraced it from the beginning. And they were like, yeah, we're going to take this everywhere that would make a show like this. And so they did. They took me around to pretty much everywhere. And luckily, we landed at Netflix.
I am surprised in a way that Netflix is less and less wanting to do shows brought to them from outside people.
Right.
But for you, they made an exception.
They did, yeah. I mean, you know, again, I don't know how things work sometimes. And I've heard other people on your show talk about this, but it's true. There is just a certain amount of luck sometimes that's involved or some sort of special alchemy.
Was it that somebody loved it? Somebody must have loved it.
Well, you know, to be honest, it was really well received pretty much everywhere we took it. So there were multiple offers from different places. And I really saw it on Netflix because I wanted to try my hand at that bingey kind of model. Mm. I had
been... Thank you for destroying my peace of mind while I binged this thing because it worked. Whatever you were thinking, it did work.
Well, I'm glad. That's awesome. But, you know, writing for multi-camera sitcoms, you're writing sort of one episode at a time. It's sort of, they're sort of one-offs.
And there's like a thing of setup joke, right?
Yeah, it's pretty formulaic. You know, I mean, it can be done really well, but it can be a little...
Very fun to watch, but maybe not as freeing to write.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it was for the first many years, but 10 years in, it was I was ready to try something else.
So you went in to pitch this to some producers after a really crazy week.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, basically this idea was born out of a pitch meeting, and it was about a week after I turned 40. And on the day I turned 40, my cousin died unexpectedly of a heart attack.
And he was not an old man.
No, he was 50, you know, a very beloved family member. And at the time I was trying to get pregnant. I was like in my fifth year.
Yes, I read this very sad piece that you wrote for Glamour.
Yes.
About the, I mean, it was, you don't lose your humor, but the pain of, you know, you're at somebody's baby shower or your mm-hmm. friends are pregnant or whatever. And it's just a constant nightmare, honestly.
Yeah, it was a really difficult time because it's like, you know, after year 5 of, you know, fertility
struggle.
Stuff and being on hormones and just never getting the result that you're hoping for, it really does just take you to a dark place. And I was certainly in a dark place when I took this pitch meeting about a week later. And I was told they have a bunch of ideas. You don't have to bring anything. And so I show up for this meeting, and it was very clearly the end of the day. I was definitely the last writer they were meeting with. You know, like all the good fruit had been picked over on the platter. It was just honeydew. And I sat down, and they were like, you know what? We're sick of our ideas. Do you have any? And I like really, truly did not, which just for any writers out there, just always have an idea in your back pocket because just better to be prepared. It's just something. And I really didn't have anything. And so I sort of stalled and we started talking and I didn't even realize it in the moment. But I think based on where I was emotionally, I just was like, they wanted a show for two women. So I said, okay, one of them is a widow. And she goes to a grief group and she meets the other woman, but the other woman, well, she's not exactly who she says she is because I don't want to spoil anything.
No spoilers.
Yeah. And so, you know, they were intrigued by that one line, two line pitch. And I just was relieved that something came out of my mouth, honestly.
Improv.
There it is again. And, you know, at the end of that meeting, they were like, we'd love to hear more about that.
And you were like, yes, I have it highly developed.
Yes.
Just I'll share it with you later.
Yes. Let me get my 40-page treatment out for you. So I went away from that meeting and I kept thinking about that idea. And I think because I was in such a raw place, I just had to make the show about what I was going through. Even though I didn't consciously set out to do that, I think that's just what happened.
There was a loss theme.
I wanted to write a show about grief, loss, and the power of friendship to, you know, get you through those things. Because for me, my friends have been my constant buoy in the storm. And that's where the idea came from. And I kept developing it. And then I eventually brought it to my studio, you know, who were definitely expecting me to bring them some like wacky multi-camera comedy. And I pitched Dead to Me instead. And the rest is history, I guess.
The first person I think cast was Christina Applegate.
Yes.
So she thought she was going to be Judy, who is the sort of the more free-spirited, softer, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
A little goofier.
Yeah.
And Jan is sort of very angry. She's defined by a lot of anger. So
yes.
You have to say to her, you're the Jen.
Yeah. It was
like,
it was a funny conversation. She did think that she was being offered Judy. And I think just because she's used to being sort of like the more comic, quirky, free-spirited character. And I did have to sit with her and say, I know, I think that you have a lot of Jen in you if you allowed yourself to. You know, at first, it is sort of an awkward thing where you're like, no, you're a very angry person. I wasn't saying that she was a very angry person. I just thought that it would be really interesting to see someone that we know one way be this other way.
She certainly seems comfortable in the role. I mean, I'm not saying she's an angry person. I'm saying it's not like she didn't kill it.
Yeah, I mean, I think she absolutely had this almost otherworldly inhabitants of this role. Like, it was astonishing on set every day to watch her just do her thing.
I don't want to get into a spoilery thing, but the character, as in life, has a mastectomy. And was that her? Did she bring that to you as an idea?
She did. She did bring that.
I mean, I would imagine it would be really hard if it'd be like, guess what? I've got a great idea. What if your character?
I mean, yeah. I would have never borrowed from her personal life, you know, to inform the character. But when she brought it to me, we were already in production. The episode was already written. You know, she was sort of digging into her role and her backstory and the scene in episode 4 where she first talks about it. And she said, you know, there's a reason why marriages fracture. There's a reason why this couple kind of went their separate ways. And she said, what if Jen had a double mastectomy? And I thought, what a brave and generous pitch from her. And it just made sense immediately. And anything that we can put in the show that feels like a subject matter that is relevant and relatable to women that you don't often see, I'm really interested in doing that. So as soon as she pitched that, I was like, yeah, that's going in. Yeah. And we just tried to find an organic way to fold it into this whole show, but not have it be sort of like a very special episode about,
right,
you know,
right,
Jen's, you know, double mastectomy.
Right.
So, you know, hopefully we did that. And, you know, I'm really proud of the fact that not only that she offered her own history to the role, but just grateful for the opportunity to tell that story.
So you just got renewed.
We just got renewed. Yeah.
Mazel tov.
Thank you so much.
I did read you said you could do this for a long time.
I could. I guess what I would say is like I would work with these people forever. I want to tell the story until it's logically concluded. You know, I don't think this is a 11 season show, but these characters are so fun to write and that relationship is so enjoyable to watch that given that we're always writing around the themes of grief and loss. There's sort of a never-ending well of stories to tell around that.
Liz Feldman is the creator of Dead to Me, now streaming on Netflix. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. What a pleasure to be here.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's show with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.